Welcome to Excess Returns, where we focus on what works over the long term in the markets. Join us as we talk about the strategies and tactics that can help you become a better long-term investor.
Justin Carboneau and Jack Forehand are principals at Validia Capital Management. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Validia Capital. No information on this podcast should be construed as investment advice. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of clients of Validia Capital.
Hey guys, this is Justin. In this Show Us Your Portfolio episode, we are joined by another great former Excess Returns guest. This time we sit down with Buckingham Strategic Wealth's Larry Swedra, prolific author and educator, to talk about his personal portfolio and investing approach. Larry helps us understand what long-term investing and being evidence-based is all about. We also get into why he goes beyond traditional stocks and bonds and into less liquid areas and what he looks for in those alternative types of investments. Full of wisdom, knowledge, and investing history, Larry offers up some thoughts and insights for all different types of investors. As always, thank you for listening. Please enjoy the Show Us Your Portfolio episode with Buckingham's Larry Swedra. This episode is brought to you by Alpha Architect for Advisors. Whether you're an established firm or just starting out, you know the right systems can be the difference maker to achieving your growth goals. That's why Alpha Architect now offers a suite of turnkey model portfolios that can be customized to fit your practice. Built on Alpha Architect's decades of rigorous academic research, our model portfolios aim to systematize portfolio management so that you can spend less time tinkering with funds and more time finding your next great client. Systemize today to save time tomorrow. That's building with conviction. That's Alpha Architect for Advisors. To learn more about Alpha Architect's model portfolios and to schedule a consultation, visit advisors.alphaarchitect.com/models. That's advisors, A-D-V-I-S-O-R-S, .alphaarchitect.com/models. Alpha Architect for Advisors, built with conviction. Hi, Larry. How are you? Thank you so much for joining us again.
Great pleasure to be back.
We're going to do this topic and discussion. It's the Show Us Your Portfolio series, where we get on with someone like you and talk about how you think about your own personal portfolio and investment strategy and what's important to you with regards to your investments. And I think what's going to be cool about this is I know there's some sort of core principles that you believe in that will follow, but obviously with your sort of evidence-based approach to investing and all the knowledge that you have investing, like what I'm interested in learning about is how sort of that all coalesces with your personal investment strategy. So I'm really looking forward to this and always appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
One of the places we like to start is talking about or thinking about what your actually biggest long-term goals are that you're trying to achieve with your investments. So, I mean, let's just start there. When you think about your personal portfolio, what are your goals?
Right. Well, I wrote a book, Your Complete Guide to a Successful and Secure Retirement, and we talk about in that book what your goals should be. And one of the things I try to teach highly wealthy people is that once you've won the game, you should stop playing. So the strategy to get rich is very different than the strategy to stay rich, which is to preserve wealth, not necessarily to try to accumulate more. So the first thing you want to do is establish what your needs are, how much money I'm going to need in retirement. You also might consider what your desires are. So you may desire to take two trips to Europe or anywhere in the world you want to go, twice a year, go travel, see the world, buy a new car every 3 years, have a second home in Colorado if you don't live there the rest of the year. Those would be desires, but they're not necessarily needs, right? And so what are the things you really need? What are your things you're willing to desire? Are you willing to take the risks to meet those desires as well? And then you have to think about what economists call your marginal utility of wealth, which if you think about that, it looks kind of like an elephant like this. So when someone's starting out, getting out of college, they have no net worth, maybe even some debt. The next dollar that they can save and invest is worth a lot to them in wealth. But let's say once you reach, let's just pick a number like $2 million. Once you reach 2 million, if you can turn it into three, great. That will obviously more money is better than less, but it doesn't likely change your lifestyle all that much or the quality of your life. Because once you have enough money to not worry about putting food on the table and shelter and maybe providing a good education for your kids, the good things in life are either free or relatively cheap, right? I get more joy out of playing games with my grandchildren or taking a long walk in a beautiful park around the lake with my wife. I don't need to spend a lot of money to do those things. So that's what you want to figure out. And once you've reached that kind of top of the elephant's back where the marginal utility worth is bending sharply to the right, still more money is better than less, so the curve never turns down. But once it gets to be pretty flat, you should say, I don't need to take more risk. Some people may want to. They may even have a bequeathed desire to leave a lot of money, either to charity or their kids, and that may cause them to take more risk. But the question is, do you really need to? And so that's what you want to focus on, is achieving your life goals and your portfolio should enable that to happen. So set your life goals, figure out what are the needs and desires. If you can afford the desires, great, but you shouldn't take a lot of risk to do that.
I remember there was this chart floating around Twitter that had a big pie, and it said, like, what is wealth? And then it said money. And then beneath it, it says, what is real wealth? And it had that circle, but broken out into different sections. And it was like health, family, community, you know, your money, your portfolio was in there, but all these other things that actually produce true like wealth and happiness for people. So that chart always just jumps out at me.
Yeah, Justin, there's some good academic research, pretty much consistent all around the world, that once you reach a certain level of income, more income doesn't make you more happy. All right. And in the United States, of course, it's going to depend on whether you live in New York or Hope, Arkansas. But the average level is about $80,000 a year today, where people who make more than $80,000 are no happier than the people who make $80,000, which tells you that the things that bring joy to us aren't really driven by things. They're driven by our experiences, and those things, you know, don't necessarily have to cost you a lot of money, as we talked about.
Just in terms of the way that you kind of think about your own retirement, I mean, do you envision that you'll continue to try to work in some way, shape, or form for, you know, as long as you mentally can? Do you have other things that you want to do or pursue in your retirement?
Yeah, well, one, I got lucky in my career, so I could have retired 30 years ago if that was what I wanted to do. But as I point out in my book, Your Complete Guide to a Successful and Secure Retirement, the first chapter is planning a life in retirement. And I think this might shock most of your listeners. If I were asked the question, what's the highest suicide rate in the United States, I would have guessed teenage girls. And the answer is recently retired men. And because they get a large part of their sense of net worth and their friendships are at work, their success and their careers are out of that. And when they retire, if they don't have a life planned in retirement to maybe go work in a hospital as a candy striper or do tax returns or do some charitable work or take classes at a college, something that gives you a reason to get up in the morning and stimulates you emotionally and gives you a feeling of connection, there's, you know, an old saying is you can judge your happiness by the number of 3 o'clock in the morning friends you have. In other words, people, you could pick up the phone and at 3 a.m. and say, I need your help, and they'll come. And if you're not, if you made all your friends at work and you got your sense of fulfillment from your work, if you don't have a life planned in retirement, that's why the suicide rate is that high. So my line is, when it becomes work, I'll retire. I love to do the research and writing and education. And my company has allowed me, while I'm no longer, participating in running the company as I did for 25 years or so, I'm still doing most of the education and writing and research So that's how I get my fulfillment. I get emails from people all over the world to read my blogs. I'll never meet them, but they thank me for helping them. I answer their questions, and that gives me a sense of satisfaction.
So we probably shouldn't expect you to hang it up and hit the golf course anytime soon.
No, it would be the pickleball court, which I have in my own driveway. So
my parents do that too, by the way. They love that. They've gotten like really into it. Before we talk about the actual asset classes you invest in, I want to talk first of all about the framework sitting on top of it. So when you think about like different assets you invest in, what is sort of the criteria you use to determine whether something is appropriate for your portfolio?
Yeah. So the framework, I think the way everyone should build portfolios, or at least think about them, is number one, that they should build the portfolio where the theory is based upon academic research, peer-reviewed, published journals, not opinions from Jim Cramer or Business Week or CNBC. But, you know, just like we shouldn't take medical advice from Reader's Digest, we should take it from the New England Journal of Medicine, right? So in our world, the financial equivalents are the Journal of Finance, the Journal of Portfolio Management. So we want to be evidence-based or science, right? Based investing, whatever words you think are appropriate. So that's rule number one, right? It shouldn't be opinion. It should be evidence-based. The evidence leads us to draw one conclusion, which is if it certainly is possible to outperform the market through active management strategies, which you could define as individual stock picking and or market timing. It's possible to do so, but the odds of doing so are so poor, you shouldn't try. So you should be what I would call a systematic investor. I don't like the word passive. I don't even use any index funds, but they would all fit into what I would call passive there, because there's no individual stock picking or market timing going on. When I wrote my first book in 1998, Charles Ellis, who wrote a much more famous book than mine, happened to his book, Winning the Loser's Game, came out at the same time. And in his book, he called active management the loser's game because he found about 20% of active managers were generating statistically significant outperformance before taxes. After taxes, of course, the number would be a lot smaller for taxable investors because taxes are generally the highest cost of active management. So let's just arbitrarily cut that in half. Today, the research shows that even by 2010, so about 12 years after I wrote my book and Ellis published his, that number had dropped to about 2%. So let's say half of that, 1% after taxes. So again, still possible to outperform the market, but it's getting more and more difficult, as I wrote in my book, co-authored with Andy Berkin, The Incredible Shrinking Alpha. So we're saying the market is becoming more and more efficient, which makes it highly unlikely that you'll outperform on a risk-adjusted basis. So that's our first principle. Evidence-based should be then leading you, based on that evidence, to be a systematic investor. All right. Now, if you believe markets are efficient, there's only one logical conclusion you should draw, which is that all risk assets have to have very similar risk-adjusted returns. That must be true because if asset A, let's call that U.S. stocks, has higher expected returns than asset B, let's call that emerging market stocks, then what would happen? Cash would flow out of emerging market stocks, driving their valuations down. Doesn't change the earnings. So you drive up expected returns, and U.S. stocks cash would come in, driving up valuation, didn't change the earnings. So the expected returns have to come down until you get an equilibrium. So all risk assets, whether it's private credit, real estate, reinsurance, whatever it might be, should have very similar risk-adjusted returns. Now, that doesn't mean similar returns, right? It means similar risk-adjusted returns, and we have to also account for more than volatility because risk is not just volatility. We don't have normal distributions in the asset. So we have to think about things investors care about, which are what technical terms, skewness and kurtosis, which are the fat tails and how big they are. Does something look like a lottery ticket where most of the returns are bad, but you got a chance to hit the home run, right? That's an example. Or are there opportunities to have huge losses, but most of the time you're hitting singles and winning? That's like riding puts on the S&P 500. Most of the time, because the market goes up, you'll make money. And then about once a decade, you might go bankrupt because the market's crashed. And we also have to consider liquidity. So David Swensen of Yale thought long ago that he recognized that he could own a lot of illiquid assets because Yale only would spend, say, 7% a year or 5% a year. So he could earn a big illiquidity premium, which depending on the asset might be anywhere from 1.5% to 3% or even more. So if you don't need liquidity, which most investors don't for at least some portion, you ought to be thinking about loading up on illiquid assets, because for you, that illiquidity premium is as close to a free lunch as we can get in the world of investing. If markets are efficient, and we believe they are, then all risk assets should have similar risk-adjusted returns. And if you believe that, which the evidence says you should as well, then there's only one logical conclusion about how to build a portfolio, which is that you should own as many different unique sources of risk that meet the criteria that Andy Burkin and I put in our book, Your Complete Guide to Factor-Based Investing, which is that there's an evidence of a premium above T-bills, and that evidence is persistent over very long periods of time and across economic regimes. It should be pervasive, like all around the world it works, so it wasn't a lucky outcome in the U.S. It should be, where it's appropriate, robust to various definitions, because the value only works using book. The value, how do you know that wasn't luck? The idea should work for price to cash flow, EBITDA to enterprise value. When momentum should work, whether you use a short-term signal or a long-term. It also has to have evidence that it survives transactions costs. It doesn't do you to get a 3% premium to make something up in small caps if it costs you 5% to trade it. And lastly, there has to be logical risk-based or behavioral-based reasons for you to believe the premium will persist. I prefer risk-based explanations because risk can't be arbitraged away, although premiums can shrink if lots of people create a crowded trade or drive valuations way up, like they did for U.S. stocks in March of 2000, right? So the premium did shrink. But in theory, at least, you know, equity should always have higher expected returns than T-bills. But I will accept behavioral explanations because there are limits to arbitrage that prevent sophisticated investors from shorting stocks and driving the prices back. So I want to create, just to make a simple example, think of a pie chart, maybe like a slice, and then take your pizza cutter and cut it into 8 slices. And I want to own like 8 different pieces. And I would just add this one other point. The more uncorrelated assets you add, and we can talk about which ones I consider, then the less fixed income you need in a portfolio, the less safe fixed income you need, because you have a lot of different assets that are also uncorrelated, not just with stocks and bonds, but with the other risk assets. So that means you're dampening the risk of the portfolio, making it more efficient and dramatically cutting the tail risk. I wrote about that in my book, Reducing the Risk of Black Swans.
So if we were to look at your portfolio as a whole, based on what you said earlier and what you just said now, would it be fair to assume that the beta of your portfolio is probably fairly low and you're pursuing like an absolute return type strategy?
It's certainly direction. I'll give you a little bit of history here to be helpful. So when I was young, and I had a good stable job. At least I thought I did. I was 100% equities. I ran trading rooms for some of the largest financial institutions in the world. So I had an appetite. I thought I could deal with the risks well. And then I hit a home run, if you will, and built a business and we sold it. And now I had the sufficient money to retire. And I immediately, upon getting that check, went down to a 60-40 portfolio. I didn't need to take that much risk anymore. Several years later, I joined Buckingham and did quite well there. And we sold our company to Focus Financial. I got another big home run. And I then, upon getting that, dropped my equity allocation down to 30% because I just wanted to sleep well. I had given my kids enough money that they would never have to worry about putting food on the table either. So I had fulfilled all of my goals, and having more money wasn't going to change my life. I want to have the time and be able to spend with my kids and do things I like traveling all over the world. And I used to be only public liquid securities, very low cost systematic strategies. But about 7 or 8 years ago, there was a big change in the markets with the introduction of what is called an interval fund structure. So the interval fund structure allowed companies like Stone Ridge and now Cliffwater and others to bring to market illiquid assets that you can't put in a daily liquid mutual fund for the simple reason that the contracts are more than a year. So for example, you make a 7-year loan, that's a private loan to a company, you can't have daily liquidity for that. You buy a reinsurance contract that lasts for a year to protect people against earthquakes and hurricanes. You can't have daily liquidity because that contract and the risks are there for a year. So the interval fund said this: you can create a fund, but it must have at least 5% quarterly liquidity, meaning 20% a year. Then, and you have to show that you hold liquid assets, lines of credit, so you could meet that liquidity need. And that opened up the market to bringing assets that the Yales and Harvards of the world had been investing in for decades, exploiting this illiquidity premium and adding uncorrelated assets to individuals, and competition has started to drive those prices down. So you no longer have to pay 2 and 20 to get access to these vehicles. Now, most of them aren't cheap because they are more expensive to run. In some cases, you're really running the reinsurance company and you can't, it's not like buying cat bonds, which you could do fairly cheaply. So you're going to pay more, but so you should care about the expenses. But what you really care about is the net return after expenses. So now my portfolio, as other asset classes have been added, and by the way, even in the private vehicles, competition has really come in. Blackstone was really a pioneer in this. They made the decision to make available to the higher net worth individual investors the same products at the same pricing they were charging the big institutions. So instead of 2 and 20, for example, their private real estate fund, BREIT, which has significantly outperformed the much cheaper Vanguard or Dimensional real estate funds by several percent a year since inception. But you're not paying 2 and 20 now. Their fund is 1.25% and I think 12.5% above a 5% hurdle. Not exactly cheap, but there are some significant benefits, including tax benefits, because most of the return is return to capital. So you should care. You're paying more. You should expect, hopefully, get a higher return. And much of that is an illiquidity premium. Here's one thing I can teach your investors pretty simple. So Justin, you have a choice here. You can own asset A or asset B. Asset A is your, let's call it your Citicorp, okay? and you own credit card debt, and let's just imagine the average yield is 20% and the expected defaults are 9%, and it costs you 1% to service that debt. So your expected return is 10%. Now, you say I've only got a certain amount of capital at Citicorp, right? But I've got clients who keep wanting of using credit lines. So how can I support them? Well, you can create an asset-backed security, an ABS, sell off some of those debts, continue to earn the 1% servicing fee, and now the yield might drop to 7% because it's daily liquid and people are willing to pay a price to get daily liquidity. Now, Justin, you're got money sitting in an IRA. I imagine you're not withdrawing anything from that these days, right?
Correct.
And even if you were 90 and you were not taking more than your R&D, which is the case for most higher net worth individuals, the R&D is only 10%. And yet there's a interval fund that gets you a minimum of 5% a quarter. So you can certainly get out, you know, that 10 or 20% you want a year at a minimum. Which would you rather own in your IRA? The 10% expected return and it's illiquid, or the 7% and it's daily liquid?
Probably, I would imagine the 10% that's illiquid. Yeah. I mean, that's 3% excess return. And I know I don't need the money. All I'm taking out is the RMD every year.
Yeah. And you're not even taking that now. Now, what you have to think is there are unexpected events that might cause you to want it, right? So you may not want to have 100% of your IRA in illiquid assets, but you might put 30, 40, 50%. And that's exactly what the Harvards and Yales the world do. Their portfolios today are north of 50% alternatives. My portfolio, as these vehicles have become available and getting cheaper at the same time, adding new asset classes, I'm now above 40% alternatives and moving that up to more like 50%. And I still keep a significant number of very safe, liquid assets like as either CDs or MIGAs, maximum yield guaranteed annuities, which are really CDs from insurers when their yields are higher, or CDs or AA, AAA munis. But it used to be 70% of my portfolio 10 years ago, and now it's down to 30 and probably headed more to 20. Because I continue to add other assets that are uncorrelated. And the more, as I said, you're able to add uncorrelated, I believe you can own less safe fixed income. My equity allocation will probably stay in the roughly 30% range. So I'll be more like 30, 20, and 50% alternatives.
You talked about these uncorrelated return streams reducing your need to hold traditional fixed income. Do you do anything like with government bonds, corporate bonds, like the more standard fixed income? Do you do anything with that?
I don't own any corporate bonds. I think there are far better ways to invest. For example, I have a very significant allocation to Cliffwater's alternative lending fund, which makes loans to middle market companies with EBITDAs. Let's call it roughly $100 million or more. They're all senior, secured, and backed by private equity. So you know that there are firms standing behind them. If they get in trouble, might be willing to step up and add equity to prevent them from getting wiped out. There's an index that Cliffwater runs of these types of loans. It's had a history of 25 basis points a year in default losses. That includes through the 2020 recession. That fund has no term risk, floating rate loan. Its current yield after expenses is 11. Now you can own a high yield bond fund, corporate credit, get somewhere, I haven't looked lately, let's call it 7 or 8. It's got daily liquidity, but it's got much worse credit risk. and it has a lot of duration risk, which I don't want. So I'd much rather own the Cliffwater Fund. I can't think of anybody who should own really Vanguard High Yield Fund instead, unless you absolutely need liquidity. And if you need liquidity, you shouldn't be owning a risky high yield bond fund. And the alternative might be, you know, CDs or treasuries getting you 5. So I think there's this big 6% premium, which is mostly an illiquidity premium. And I think also a lack of understanding of the market there. So to me, that's like the best investment I could think. And there are other good funds now being created, coming to market, that I think will replicate, that experience. Cliffwater won't be the only ones out there. There are a lot of private vehicles that are also in that space, like Blackstone's BCRED and others. But that's an example. But I do, as I said, I do own significant numbers of AA and AAA rated munis. I own a significant number currently of MIGAs, which I bought when their yields were much higher than CDs or munis on an after-tax basis as well. I'm now letting them run off and actually doing as much early redemptions as I can to, because I can get much better yields in things like Cliffwater's fund.
How about the portion of your portfolio that you do have in equities? What are you doing there? I mean, are you using factors? Are you doing more like index type stuff? What are you doing there?
Yeah. So here's an example of my own belief. If you think about one way to invest would be to own the total stock market. That's certainly the cheapest and the most tax efficient. But that loads a portfolio up with one single risk called market beta. Now, we know there are other factors in the literature that have significant premiums, and they're either low correlation or negative correlation with market beta. And therefore, if you believe that all risk assets like value as a factor in size and profitability, quality, momentum, they should have the same risk-adjusted returns as market beta, right? Then why do I want to own only market beta and have big tail risk? Because market beta can get crushed. And it can happen to get crushed at the same time as your safe bonds are getting crushed, as what happened in 2022. The other thing is any risk asset, including market beta, can have very long periods of underperformance, which can be really damaging in creating tail risk and sequence risk, especially for retirees. So people look, for example, at value, which had a dark winter, I call it, from November of 2016 through October 2020. That was only about 4 years, all right? But it really underperformed the market. It didn't do poorly. Value stocks did okay. They just dramatically underperformed growth stocks. So a lot of people panic and sell, right? 3 years they think is a long time. Well, if you go back to 1929, market beta was negative. So meaning stocks underperformed T-bills for 15 years. From 29 to 43. It underperformed for 17 years from 66 to 82. And it underperformed for 13 years from 2000 to 12. That's a reason to diversify, not avoid a risk asset. I'm not telling anyone to avoid market beta. There's a logical risk premium that's persistent, pervasive, robust, implementable. But it's a reason to diversify so you don't happen to have all your eggs in one risk basket at the wrong time, which is at the start of a retirement. That's why my portfolio diversifies across many factors. And the way to do that, which again, I wrote about in my book, Reducing the Risk of Black Swans, is instead of owning a market portfolio, I have a much lower allocation to equities because the equities I own all have much higher expected returns. Expected, not guaranteed. And so my portfolio is all small value stocks. So I have a loading on factors of about, for my portfolio, about 0.3, so 30% in the market. I also have a loading of about point two or three on value, point three or so on size, point two or three, you know, whatever on quality and momentum. So I've got multiple factors, and my portfolio is much more likely to do this instead of do this. So in 2022, after doing poorly from 16 to 20 because of value's dark winter, my portfolio, including my alternatives, every one of which was up when the market and bonds both got crushed, my own portfolio was actually up a bit in 2022. Now, it had underperformed the 3 years before that. You have to be willing to accept this tracking variance and not look like everybody else or the market, but that's not your objective. Your objective should be sleep well and achieve your financial goals. And the way to do that in basic economics is diversify.
Do you do anything with any of the funds that pursue factors on a long-short basis, or is it all long only?
No. So I use the funds of Dimensional, Avantis, and Bridgeway as they're long only. And then I add AQR's long short factor funds because it provides further diversification, adding exposure to these factors, not only in stocks, but in bonds and commodities and currencies, as well as adding some other factors in there. So I have an exposure to that fund as well. And by the way, after it performed poorly for several years again because of value really getting crushed. In 21 and 22, it had spectacular returns and is, I think it's about flat or up slightly this year.
You can correct me if I'm wrong. I'm assuming you're not a market timing guy or a factor timing guy, but I'm wondering, is there any ever any instance where you would look at something like that? Like if the market was really, really expensive, would you ever take your equity exposure down?
Yeah.
Or would you just never do anything like that?
Well, I will say I'm not a market timer, but I will say I will, using Cliff Asnett's words, sin a little. So I'm not 100% non-market timer, but I will move my asset allocations a bit. And in one case, I moved it dramatically. In late 98, I believe the U.S. market was already in bubble territory, and there was a great risk that the market held by growth stocks, meaning, could crash. The rest of the market, the valuations were about historical averages. So value stocks were still trading at PEs in the 12, 13, but the PEs of the market had gone up to like 30. Now, of course, I knew they could go higher, and they did, and I looked pretty dumb for about 15 or 18 months, but eventually I was proved right, and value went on the biggest run and largest run in history. But I moved from about two-thirds value and about 50% small stocks. I went to 100% value in the summer of 98. And I've stayed that way since. So that was one instance where I got out. The other big change I made, but I've stayed the same since then. I'll tend to tweak a little bit. So a couple of years ago, emerging market values got as cheap as we've ever seen them relative to develop. So instead of rebalancing to my global market of about 1/8, of the market, I moved it to 15%. I added more. So I cheated a little bit there. So I will, you know, move my asset allocation slightly within equity without changing my equity allocation there. The other case where I did do a big change was about 2 years ago or so. I said I thought the Fed had made horrible and dumb decisions that were easily pointed out as mistakes, and that we were headed for much higher inflation and rates would have to go way up. And I sold everything I owned that had more than 5 year maturity and moved a lot of assets more to a floating rate like Cliff Waters debt there. Well, in that case, I turned out clearly to be right there. And I don't think that one was hard to foresee. Of course, I said the same thing and other times, but I've probably been wrong and I may not recall them, but I did get that one right.
you talked about emerging market value. What is your view in general on international diversification? You know, I think there's sort of like two views here. There's the kind of the Jack Bogle view that you're getting everything you need, you know, in the United States. And then there's sort of the more academic view that, you know, when you look at diversification, you're actually getting a lot of value from international investing. So
I think
how do you think about international investing with your portfolio?
I think Jack Bogle was clearly wrong from a theoretical perspective. And it's easy to prove him wrong. All you have to do is ask the question, if instead of Jack Bogle being lucky and being born in the U.S., he was born in Japan, and it's now 1990, and he's looking at the returns and says, hey, gee, why the hell would I want to own anything but Japan? I could own Japanese multinational stocks, and they have lots of exposure to the U.S. and the rest of the globe. And the next 30 years, you get no return, right? None. Jack Bogle got lucky, in my opinion, that there's, you know, I'm making no prediction here. But it's certainly possible, and I could make an argument why you even might believe it, the U.S. could look like Japan over the next 30 years. You cannot deny that risk exists. And in my opinion, only a foolish investor puts all their eggs in one basket. Logically, the starting point, I think, economic theory tells you, in its collective wisdom, the market thinks U.S. has got, call it 55% of the global market cap, developed markets maybe about 30, and I'm just making the numbers up now, emerging markets 15. So that should be your starting point. On top of that, if you're a young investor, say like Justin, all of his working capital, or sorry, his labor capital is in the U.S. So that means he should have a foreign tilt to diversify his labor capital in case the U.S. does turn out to be the next Japan and his labor capital becomes at risk. So that's a real issue I see, is a lot of people don't take into account their labor capital, which for most young investors dominates their financial capital. You know, you're 64 years old, your labor capital doesn't matter too much anymore. But when you're 25, it's not on your balance sheet, so people don't think about it. But I wrote about the need to consider that in my retirement book.
Just one more for me before I hand it back to Justin. Do you do any kind of private company investing, whether it be like angel investing or private equity, or do you anything like that?
In private investing, the literature up until recently had suggested that while there are clearly some private equity firms who have delivered outstanding results over the long term, unless you're Yale University, you probably don't have access to them. And their expenses are very high, and the ones you have access to, while they may have outperformed the market, evidence says they do, before their expenses, or because they're getting big illiquidity premiums, right? I don't think necessarily because they're geniuses, but they're getting big illiquidity premiums, right? After expenses, they were taking all the alpha. And you should be getting a 2 or 3% premium for that illiquidity, right? And you're going to have likely an undiversified portfolio, certainly one that's less diversified than the market. What happened over the last decade or so, really more like 5-6 years, as I mentioned, some of these vehicles are now becoming much more available. Fees are coming down more to the 1-1.25 and much and lower incentive fee structures. And I think importantly, because of the Sarbanes-Oxley legislation, which in my opinion was really bad for the U.S. economy. And the reason is it raised the cost of being a public company so much that 30 years ago, I mean, I was on the board of a REIT that was going to go public, and it would have gone public with a maybe $100 million or less valuation. Nobody would think to do that today. It's just too expensive. The company that called Focus Financial that bought Buckingham Strategic Wealth, my firm, waited until it had a $1 billion valuation before it felt it could justify going public. So if you go back 25 years, there were about 8,000 or more stocks. Jack, do you know what the number of public securities is today?
It's a lot lower than that. I don't know the exact number, but 3,000 or something like that?
It's about 3,600 or so. And so if you want to invest in the more dynamic, growth-oriented, you know, companies where the innovation tends to happen, you can't do it in the public markets anymore, right? So for that reason, I want to get a little more diversified, and I'm doing it that way through some of the private firms. And you want to stick, I think, with the leading players because it does show it makes a difference. The bigger players actually, an MIT professor wrote a paper looking at the research on outperformance. And he found that there are a group of leading people who do get better returns. And now the question is, why do they get better returns? Is it because they're better selectors, or is it because they have a reputational value? And that allows them to charge more for their capital. So Jack, just to give you an example here, say you're an entrepreneur and you come and you want to raise $100 million. You come to Larry Swedrow Venture Capital and I offer you, okay, I like your presentation. Here's $100 million. I want 25% of the firm. And then you go to Kleiner Perkins or KKR or somebody like that. And they say, Jack, we like your presentation. We'll give you the $100 million, but we want 30% of the company instead of 25% of the company. You still might choose them because they could bring a lot of benefits to the table in terms of talented people, industry expertise. They could really help you. Lots of connections, help you get in public, help you strategize. They could bring resources to the table. So by charging more for the capital, the flip side of a higher cost of capital is a higher return to the investors. And so we don't know. It's probably some skill, of course. That's how you got maybe the reputation in the first place. But clearly, I think if you want to play in that space, I think you want to stick with the leading firms with long histories of strong performance. So I do have private equity investments through some of the bigger players in the industry with long track records of success.
Just three more questions here, one for me, one from Jack, and then our standard closing question. But I wanted to ask you about investor behavior. And, you know, from where you sit in your seat and all of the research you've done and the books you've written, I mean, it's like in your blood, the ability to stay disciplined, to diversify, to be evidence-based. And, you know, you gave those examples before of positions that you were in that did nothing for 3 years or underperformed, but then finally on the back end, you saw the benefit of those. But I'm wondering, you know, the vast majority of investors aren't built or wired that way. It's actually just probably the opposite. After like 12 months of something not working, you know, they're moving on to the next thing. So I guess the two questions inside this question is, one, how does an investor overcome that? And two, does it lend itself to working with, for a lot of people, working with a professional that can help, sort of a good professional advisor that can help sort of overcome these things?
Yeah. Well, one of my favorite lines is the worst mistake that investors tend to make is they think that when it comes to performance of risk assets, 3 years, or managers, but not. They think 3 years is a long time to judge performance, 5 years, very long time, and 10 years in eternity. Financial economists worth their salt will tell you that 10 years is very likely to be noise and you should ignore it. I gave you three examples covering 45 of the last 94 years, almost half that period, where the S&P underperformed T-bills with at least 13 years and as long as 17, right? And yet some people probably wouldn't abandon the market, but they would abandon value for 3 years of poor performance, or reinsurance saw huge amounts of money leave because we had 3 years of bad performance. I think it was in 17, 18, 19, or 18, 19, 20. 3 years is nothing, right? And they end up almost always selling after things have gone down, when expected returns are now much higher because valuations are lower, or in the case of reinsurance, the premiums have doubled in effect. And so the expected returns are now much higher. So what you have to do is have, one, a knowledge of financial history. And that knowledge will tell you that every single risk asset goes through these long periods of underperformance, which is the reason you diversify in the first place, not concentrate, because you run the risk that the one you choose, or two or three, will be the one that has that horrible performance. To me, it's completely illogical to have all your eggs in one basket if you believe markets are efficient, which you should. The second part of that question, though, is investors make the mistake of engaging in what I call, and Annie Duke wrote a book about this, called they engage in resulting. They judge the quality of a decision by the outcome instead of the quality of the decision-making process. Unless something has changed, right, you have to recognize risks show up, and it doesn't mean your decision was wrong. Warren Buffett didn't abandon value investing when it got crushed in the late 90s, and people told him he was an old fuddy-duddy, times had passed him by. And he didn't abandon it again in 17, 18, and 19, and early 20. So those are the two things. Now, to answer your other question, to me, the big benefits of a working with a wealth advisor is, one, to create a true integrated wealth plan that not only deals with the investments, but integrates it into estate, taxes, insurance, life planning, helping you plan a life in retirement, all of those things. But then the key role of the advisor is to provide the education that allows you to stay disciplined, reminding you when things are going well, like from 2000 to 08, you know, value crushed everything. We were telling clients, well, just remember 95 through 99, you know, and that's why we are rebalancing every year, not chasing value. We're selling value to buy the rest of the market to get you back to that pop. And then when it did poorly from 1720, we tell, well, remember 2000 through 7, and now we need to stay disciplined. I will tell you, no matter how much education you do, some percentage of investors just don't get it. They always fall susceptible to some guru who's telling them this time it's different. It never is. And the basic principles of investing should always apply.
As we get towards the end of these, we always like to ask a question that gets us that this idea you alluded to earlier, that not everything we invest money in is with the goal of making money. And so I like to use the example of, I have a racing sailboat. So a racing sailboat is a horrendous investment. You're basically just dumping money into it. But every Wednesday night in the summer, like now, I'm out there with my friends, we're having a beer, we're racing around the course. Like, I get great life experience out of that. And I'm just wondering if there's anything like that in your life that you maybe invest money in, that not for a return, but for the, like, the pleasure and the joy you get out of it.
Well, I think you defined it very well. The example that I use when I get asked questions by clients like that. So, number one, if you have enough money, right, that you can afford to lose some, like people will go to Las Vegas and they'll have a budget. They'll say, I'll take $1,000 and be willing to lose it at the gambling table, because they enjoy watching other people and the gambling and the experience. And if they lost it, they don't go in expecting to make money. That's their enjoyment. Okay. Nothing wrong with setting up, from a psychological standpoint, an entertainment account. But here's what I tell people. I always say this with a little bit of tongue in cheek. So when I was a kid growing up, I worked hard. I went to work after school and college while I was in school to have enough money to take girls out on dates and stuff. But, you know, I would go to the racetrack with my friends maybe four times a year. And we would go, and while they would bet $5 or $10 or even $20 if they were ahead, whatever, on a race, I would bet $2, right? Because I said, I'm not losing more than $20 on, you know, if I lost to all the race, because the money was really valuable and the entertainment experience wasn't worth more than the $20. And when those horses were galloping down the track, do you think they were cheering any harder than I was?
Yeah, no.
No, I got just as much enjoyment as they did. So I tell people, if you need enjoyment from the stock market, you ought to think about getting another life. And again, I say it with tongue in cheek. There's nothing wrong. You want to have a little fun, play the market, but recognizing you're playing the market, you're not investing, and the odds are great you're going to underperform. And the reason is pretty simple. This is something most people don't know. If you think, let's say, if we look at history, that the market got 10%. So if you ask people, what do you think the median return was? Now, the mean return was 10%, right? But the median return to stocks is much less than 10. That's because the returns are skewed. You can't lose more than 100%. But you invest in a Google, you might make 10,000% if you're lucky and smart enough to hold on forever. So most of the stocks dramatically underperform. So if you only own one or two stocks, the odds are you're going to underperform. The more stocks you own, the odds get closer and closer that you'll get the mean return. Until you own the market, then you're guaranteed to get the mean return. So diversification is the winning strategy there. Buying individual stocks is, in my opinion, speculating, not investing.
When you were giving your horse racing example, I just realized I'm doing this boat thing all wrong. I probably should be going on someone else's boat. I would get just as much joy out of it, and I'd be spending a lot less money. So maybe that's my lesson from this whole thing.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, and there are a lot of lessons sort of sprinkled throughout this. But Larry, if you could impart one lesson to your average investor from building your personal portfolio, what do you think that would be?
Yeah, I think I'd go back to my core principles. Make sure everything you're doing is based on evidence, not Jim Cramer's or anybody else's opinions. And make sure that your portfolio is highly diversified. You're not taking more risks than you have the ability, willingness, and need to take. Remember that all risk assets go through long periods of poor performance. So that's the reason why we diversify, and never engage in resulting. Don't judge the quality of your decision by the outcome. Judge it by the quality of your process. And if your process is good, it's likely you just had a period of bad luck and you need to stick with your process.
Larry, thank you for your time, your transparency, your knowledge and insight. We really appreciate it. Have a good summer.
Thank you very much. Happy to come back anytime.
This is Justin again. Thanks so much for tuning into this episode of Excess Returns. You can follow Jack on Twitter at @practicalquant and follow me on Twitter at @JJCarboneau. If you found this discussion interesting and valuable, please subscribe in either iTunes or on YouTube, or leave a review or a comment. We appreciate it.
Justin Carboneau and Jack Forehand are principals at Validia Capital Management. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Validia Capital. No information on this podcast should be construed as investment advice. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of clients of Validia Capital.